Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome. And as you can tell by the fact that Mr. Announcer is giving you a phone number, this is a phone-in talk show. This show has been rambling around WRIF for how long? Going on 40 years, I guess, if you, 36. It began in 1970. So it's been here a long time, but I'm always running into people both that call 313-298-WRIF and people that email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com that are just checking this out for the first time. So, welcome. Usually I start, although you can call 313-298-WRIF at any time. We're all ADD on this bus, so you needn't, you needn't even be responsive to what I'm saying. You can bring up something. You read something. You're thinking something. Someone told you something. You told someone something, and you want to talk about it. You want to throw it out to the WRIF audience. And if you're just joining us, you probably know, if you're calling us, that WRIF is a station in Detroit, Michigan. And we got a pretty big signal. It's a great rock station. Just heard an hour. Just heard an hour of Detroit rock and roll. Jay Hudson, who's our producer here on the Night Call show, is the host, along with Doug Podell, our midday guy, of Motor City Riffs. And, man, you know about Detroit music. Whether it's rock and roll, whether it's rhythm and blues, whether it's Motown, whether it's jazz, when you hear stuff that comes out of Detroit, you never can tell whether this is going to be the next legend. But many of you are listening around the country and around the world on the internet, either on WRIF.com or radiopower.org. So welcome to everyone. Our primary broadcast area is southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, and northern Ohio. But hey, It's a international village, isn't it? Well, what are we going to talk about? So much going on. I'm going to begin with something that may sound a little frivolous. I mean, things are going to hell badly in Iraq. I mean, that's what happens when you lie, right? When you begin something under false pretenses. When you BS people, when you take advantage of their best impulses and their fears, or our, let's put it a little more directly, our fears, our anger, our best impulses, in some cases some of the worst impulses. But you were so arrogant that you even lie to yourself. So the liars have lied to themselves. So they even believed a lot of the BS. Not so much that things about weapons of mass destruction, they never believed that, or that Iraq was involved with Al-Qaeda. They never believed that. But they did believe that this was going to be a real walkthrough, a pushover, a slam dunk, as one of these incompetent, evil morons running things said. So things are going to hell in Iraq. They're also going to hell in Afghanistan. The Taliban are back. Four U.S. soldiers just died there today in a bombing. GM's closing plants. Kia, the South Korean automaker, is opening a plant. Right? He's like, well, we can't make cars here in the U.S. anymore. Well, I guess it's not if you're General Motors. And they're going to open up a plant in Georgia. They're going to pay pretty decent wages. No union benefits, right? So we're heading back to the 1920s. And believe it, once they blow away all the unions, if we let them do that, all you guys, and there's not, and gals, not everyone is making close to union wages that aren't in unions, but a lot of the auto workers are, because that's one of the ways that these companies have kept unions out, is by paying them wages close or approximating union wages. Well, once that they're able to get rid of structures like the United Auto Workers, so that if all of a sudden they're making $20 an hour, and they say, we're paying you $8, you know, what the hell? Even if you don't like it, we're going to hire people that will work for it, or will take it to Mexico, right? But then people would say, well, wait a minute, I'm joining the UAW. I'm going to fight. We're going to get together as a whole unit, as a collective unit of people, and do what our fathers and grandfathers did, and get decent wages and a middle-class living for industrial work. But if the unions are gone, which is ultimately their goal, then there won't be anyone to turn to, will there? But of course, you know, the working class, the middle class, is pretty inventive. And if those old structures that are pretty bureaucratic and so far haven't shown themselves up to the task of the class warfare that's being practiced by the rich, people will just invent new ones, maybe better ones, certainly more militant ones. But Bush really ate it on that one, didn't he? I mean, that's what I mean about arrogance. Say, we're going to scare the crap out of you about Arabs. So there's this incredible Arab phobia, what do they call it? Islamophobia that's generated. And Bush is out there saying, well, we must treat everyone equal. And then on the other hand, you know how they've been acting. Anyways, Bush's approval ratings have fallen to a new low. Even the Republicans don't want to be identified with him, and they were taking him on over I just thought of something. Where is that? How Bush's brother, Marvin, is all connected up with these Dubai people. Anyway, I'm getting scattered. 313-298-WRIF. But I wanted to talk about dildos. Well, and I mean the human varieties, right? They're out there. But the Tennessee and Mississippi state legislature, rather than dealing with the problems that the states have, I mean, one of the reasons the states have problems, like Michigan and Tennessee and Mississippi, Tennessee had a pretty good state health plan for low-income people, but of course, with all the money going to Halliburton, the Carlyle Group, and Bechtel, and these munitions makers that are spending billions of our tax dollars over in Iraq, rather than doing things like having health programs in Tennessee or Michigan, they don't even have that anymore. Anyway, let me just launch into that. In Tennessee Senate Bill 3794, and I guess it's in the Tennessee House as well, it would make it illegal to sell, advertise, publish, or exhibit to another person, quote, any three-dimensional device. Whoa, what about a four-dimensional device or something like that? Anyways, any three-dimensional device designed or marketed as useful primarily for the stimulation of human genital organs. And that's a quote. And then the writer, John Spragans, is that his name? Spragans it is. For that matter, if you offer to show someone your dildo collection or possess a vibrator with the intent to show it to someone, you'd be violating this proposed state law, and don't even think about wholesaling those three-dimensional sex toys. Of course, as with all good public policy, State Senators Charlotte Birx and Representative Eric Swafford have included a few exemptions for responsible dildo users. Now, this is going on in Tennessee, right? This is going on while the state budget is going to hell. This is what they think is a problem. You know, the old thing about it, if it's not broke, don't fix it. I mean, is there a problem with dildo use in Tennessee? No. We'll continue on. Let's see. Here's the exemptions. College students and faculty, hey, attention students, are allowed to enter the sex toy trade as long as they are, quote, teaching or pursuing a course of study related to such a device. I mean, this is not a joke. I mean, these state legislators, Republicans, naturally, are a joke. So he says, like, autoerotic stimulation 101. Your doctor or psychologist will similarly be authored to prescribe the regular use of a sex toy, quote, in the course of medical or psychological treatment or care. And finally, employees of historical societies, museums, public libraries, and wait for it, it says here, public libraries are allowed to traffic in devices named Thruster, the Emperor, and the Horny Hare, provided they are doing their official duties. So the writer asks, what do Birx and Swafford have against genital stimulation? Your guess is as good as ours. At press time, staff members hadn't returned messages left Tuesday morning. Attorneys for the state of Georgia couldn't defend them either. 2 weeks ago, a federal appeals court overturned portions of a similar Georgia statute on the grounds that these advertising bans violate free speech rights. Nonetheless, this Tennessee legislative tag team went ahead and introduced their bill last Thursday, and on Monday, this last Monday, it passed a perfunctory first reading. I mean, I guess they don't want to go into rural Tennessee and say they voted for dildos. But these guys are dildos. I guess it's a man and a woman. What a couple of dildos, huh? Tennessee, it says, in other Monday developments. Tennesseans died from a lack of health care, remained poorly educated, and were among the most obese state population in the nation. I think Michigan is up there. So this is what you have passing for politics in this country to divert us from approaching sensibly and problematically and with solutions in mind to the real problems that are facing us. So healthcare, jobs, good jobs, all the benefits, a war, Bushco selling out the country to Dubai. No, it's dildos. I mean, that's the problem, right? And what business is it of theirs? You know, there's some of these apparatuses, they say in them, not to be used below the waist, because they're vibrators. And if and on the, how do I know? I don't know. You'll just have to guess how I know. I could just see them in the store, and maybe, just like I experimented with marijuana in college, maybe I experimented with vibrators and dildos in college. Now, the marijuana experiment was a success, but I don't want to get into my personal life. So I'm not going to talk anymore about, or I may just have seen it in the store. Anyways, they have these vibrators, and they always show a woman with it, like holding it on her neck. Right? Like everybody uses them for just what this bill is trying to outlaw, sexual stimulation. Except these uptight, isn't there, what was it, that song of John Lennon? I can't remember. Tricky Dick or something like that? I don't know. Anyways, but this refers to Dick Nixon, nothing else. But anyways, so these guys, they are these sexually repressive busybodies. Classic. I mean, they've got problems with this. I mean, obviously the people that use dildos, either by themselves or with other people, they don't have any problem with them because they're buying them. They want it. It somehow or other enhances their life. But these two sexually repressive busybodies, guys that aren't, and man and a woman, who aren't taking care of their own business, so they want to butt into other people's businesses. They're Budinskis. And so two things flow from this. The Budinski mode, this is what's got us in the jam in Iraq. I mean, we butted into something where we never should have. And that's that mentality. But then the sexually repressive nature, quality, characteristic of these people is what comes out in these fascistic personalities, in these right-wing, repressive, conservative personalities. It's extraordinary. It's psychology 101. You have a sexually repressive person, you have an authoritarian personality. You have a totalitarian personality. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're not having sex or anything like that. A lot of it, as we know, with these people is totally hypocritical. So you get all these preachers that get caught with hookers, and these Republican writers are always, they write these novels, and then they have like bestiality and child sexuality. I mean, they're a pack of wecks, right? You know, it's one thing. You can always get an audience talking about sex, but you're not even calling in about this. All right, so let's go to the other stuff. Do this. Oh, yeah, just before I forget this, Bush's approval ratings falling to new low. Personally, according to Bush, far fewer Americans consider Bush likable. Honest? I mean, I can't believe this. Strong and dependable. I mean, he's pretty strong. I see him cutting brush. I don't think what they mean. But a Vermont town, this town of Newfane, Vermont, in a clapboard, white clapboard town hall, voters gathered and they instructed their representative to begin filing articles of impeachment against the president, alleging that Bush misled the nation into the Iraq war and engaged in illegal domestic spying. Well, I mean, is there a doubt here? Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin has said he's going to introduce a bill of censure to censure George W. Bush, much as was done with, Andrew Jackson in 1834. That was the last time. Boy, that guy was a piece of work, too. Major Indian killer. This Jackson, not Bush. He's Bush has got his sights fixed on Iraq. But all right, let's get into this. By the way, let me reset this all. I was saying people join us that have never heard this. This is a Night Call show. My name is Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. You can, someone said, boy, you mentioned your website so much. I mean, there's lots of stuff on there. I mean, just like I want you to listen to this show, and I'm happy when people do, I'm happy when there's like 500,000 hits on my website. Not because I'm selling anything. And I can't begin to tell you how many people have come up to me in recent days and said, hey, you're Peter Werbe. I said, how do you know that? He said, I saw your picture on your website. Yeah. I met some of these right-wingers. Remember, one woman wrote me and said, how can you put your face on your website? You're one of the homeliest people I have ever seen. I don't even know how you can look in the mirror. Went on like this. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not ready. I'm not ready for Hollywood. But I don't think I'm that bad. But when you do, when you hate what someone says, same thing. Another guy writes in, I've been listening to radio all my life, and you have the worst voice I have ever heard on radio. I wrote back, gee, you really know how to hurt a guy. Anyways, that's that. PeterWerbe.com is that website number, what we call in cyberland a URL, right? 313-298-WRIF. I don't know about you, but a lot of my teachers, particularly when I was in high school, were these far right-wing patriotic types that made us say and do stuff and had just totally mainstream textbooks that only gave the official view of everything. And if you objected, I mean, they would even, I mean, one teacher would say you're a communist and what have you. So that's what we were stuck with. You know, in fact, in some way, since this was an official institution, you sort of took it for granted. If you wanted to find out the real deal, you had to go outside of class. You had to find out through other sources, other books, or now people, they go to the internet and what have you. So I think most people have heard about this teacher, Jay Benish. Actually, I met a guy the other day who taught Jay Benish at, he's from Beverly Hills, and I guess he went to Birmingham Seaholm, and actually had been his teacher while Jay Benish was in high school there. Anyways, he's back in class out in Denver, and this ends a weeks-long saga over comments he made comparing George W. Bush to Adolf Hitler. But some educators say the controversy may have a lasting effect on the teachers who like to push the envelope. You know what? Don't these people have editors? Don't when they say some cliche like push the envelope, it's not even the writer's fault. Writers writing quickly. I mean, wouldn't you think that the editor would say, well, that's such a terrible cliche, push the envelope, that I'm going to put something else in to stimulate their students? Here we go again. In suburban Denver, 10th grade student Sean Allen recorded 20 minutes of Benish's lecture to his class on Bush's State of the Union address and turned it over to conservative columnists and talk radio, sparking a national controversy. He was like on the Today Show and all that. So what happens here? Bush is compared to Hitler by the teacher, Jay Benish, and this student who might as well be in the Hitler Youth turns him in. That's what they always taught the Hitler Youth to do. Look for signs of disloyalty. So this snotty little Hitler Youth narcs on his teacher because he doesn't agree with what he said. And actually, if you read through this Jay Benish's remarks, he starts off asking them. Because you can say, you know, why didn't this little punk, and I mean that in the old-fashioned sense, not in the musical or cultural genre sense, but why did this little punk Sean Allen, this Nazi youth kid, why didn't he say, yeah, I don't agree with you. I think George W. Bush is a great president. Someone could take that little clip I just said and send it out places. Why did he do that? But no, typical conservative, right-wing, fascistic, totalitarian. What he wants Jay Benish to do is shut up. Now, this is like a social studies class and all this, a history class, something like that. And so, also, the kid could have said any number of things in support of Bush, created a dialogue. He could have challenged him, even saying, look, you have more prestige because you are the teacher, and I'm at a disadvantage. In other words, a whole dialogue could have gone on about powerhouse exerted by political leaders, and also how it's exerted on the the micro level in the class. Instead, this little Hitler youth, Sean Allen, goes and wants him removed from school so they won't have to hear disloyal statements anymore. Well, this is obviously not like Hitler youth because, or Hitler's Germany, because Jay Benish has his job back. But it's getting dicey. It's getting dicey out there. So most of us who have been subjected to extraordinarily conservative right-wing teachers and history books and political science books that have no challenge in them whatsoever to the way things developed over the last few hundred years, when anyone says anything from the left, whoa, they're not being objective. Margaret Trimmer Hartley, old buddy of mine, who's a spokeswoman for the Michigan Education Association here in our state, says it's scary. It's that mentality seeps into our school. We're doomed. We're doomed to having no dialogue. During his lecture, Benish said some of Bush's speech that night sounds like a lot of things that Adolf Hitler used to say. And then they put him on administrative leave. Yeah, he was, oh, here it is, 1996 Seaholm High School graduate, and he'd been on paid administration leave. Man, I'd like to be on paid administration leave. That's great. You get paid and you don't have to work. Actually, I love to do this. So I wouldn't like that, but most people's jobs. So it sort of goes on like that. All right. So that's not just what I have to say. I've been holding, this Christmas Day, 2005, Professors' Politics Draw Lawmakers into the Fray. And this is about a college student, Jenny Mae Brown, in Pennsylvania, that was complaining because her professor used class time to belittle George Bush in the war in Iraq. And she's an Air Force veteran. Now, I got to tell you, if I was who knows where she's at now? You know, she could belong to Iraq Veterans Against the War. We're going to be having an interview at 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time with the founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You can go to IVAW.net. IVAW.net. Yeah. Let's see. The encounters blossomed into an official legislative inquiry, putting Pennsylvania in the middle of a national debate spurred by conservatives. See, they don't like it. They wouldn't mind it whatsoever if their narrow conservative ideology dominated academia. They'd think that was just fine. And that all they had was this patriotic, empty pap cant that they substitute for any real name these people. But there's this guy, he used to be a left-winger, and he figured he probably could make more money by being a right-winger, which he does. And so he's trying to put across an academic bill of rights, which isn't really clear what it is. But here is what I would like to pose to you. Just as I said that I was subjected to all of these right-wing conservative, mindless patriotic pap by these loser teachers that didn't teach us anything other than they wanted us to follow the official party line. How about some of you that are conservatives that don't like to hear the left wing? I don't know how to break it down. I mean, I suppose if I, like I say, I would college, high school, junior high, what do they call it? Didn't they, what they call it now? Yeah. Middle school, whatever. I mean, I was right-wing conservative teachers. I never had any. But when I got to college, then I found liberal teachers. Then I found guys that opened my mind incredibly. But you could say, they were just propagandists or something like that. They said things, and then I had to compare that to reality. I had to compare that to the official views, the official histories. And, man, can't you do that without having to rat? I feel badly. Someone should have moved quickly to this call because there was someone who was objecting to me calling this snotty little punk that narked on Detroit area native Jay Benish, who got suspended for as a small part of his lecture, saying that there was a similarity between the kind of fear-mongering that Bush used and Adolf Hitler used. I think that's not a good comparison, and I think it's ineffective. But hey, buddy, call back. I'm interested to hear from you. So one of the things I'd like to hear from you is, has there been, in your experience, you were subjected to somebody from other political persuasions that you were thinking, I don't like to hear this. All right, let's take a call. This is Peter Werbe on the Night Call Show, 313-298-WRIF. If you've got emails, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's see, it's Carol in Detroit. Carol, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi. There was a couple of things. Going on with the University of Michigan television and radio stations?
No. What do you mean? What's it have to do with?
Well, the Donovan, what's his name, quit, and they say, well, we will tell you when the investigation's over. It just made me curious.
It's not making a bit of sense to me.
And also, you know, they were saying the Dubai court thing.
Uh-huh.
Court things. I heard somebody say, well, not too many American companies are big enough to take over. And I heard them mention Carlyle.
The Carlyle Group.
Yes. I said my ears perked up at that because that's really keeping it in the family, isn't it?
Yeah. Did you want to say something about Donovan?
Donovan Reynolds. He quit as the head of WUOM.
Well, that's... WRIF. All right. Use those lines. I'd like to hear from you. We'll be right back to get your calls after these.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah. fell.
WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. Open lines, we're at 313-298-WRIF. Here's a couple of things I pose. These Tennessee legislators were trying to, are trying to, not in the past tense, trying to abolish dildos in Tennessee. And this is one of the problems facing Tennesseans. The other thing is about the Colorado high school teacher that defended his lecture on Bush, where he compared him to Hitler, at least the manner in which he was presenting fear to the population of his country. And Jay Benish, he's from Beverly Hills, Michigan, and an alum, 1996 Seaholm grad, and he's back in school. And what I was wondering, whether or not you've had teachers that that challenge you with ideas that you previously didn't have. And I'm not talking to just current high school students. I mean, I went to high school a long time ago. I went to college a long time ago. And I rather remember distinctly the impact that a number of professors had. I mean, in terms of creating this openness to new ideas. So, and what do you do? What do you do? I mean, how do you teach, quote, objectively? I mean, I have a lot of friends that are high school teachers and college professors. All of them are left-wing. Every one of them. I mean, hello? Is that a surprise to you? And that comes out in the way that they teach. Although they very distinctly tell their students that this is my opinion. What is yours? Or here's what the opinion contradictory to the official one is. How do you reconcile them? And they're very good about this. And they don't want to, you know, like just have a, what they used to call a bully pulpit. A bully pulpit to which they're going to ram ideas down people's throat. I mean, that's what the right wing does. They want everybody to think the same. People on the left want people to think imaginatively, inventively, creatively. Now, all right, I'm going to tell you another problem. And I thought about whether I should even bring this up or not. I've been doing this show for a long time, as many of you know. And in terms of rating, it's wildly popular. In fact, I mentioned earlier, somebody had written in and said that I was one of the ugliest people they'd ever seen. And John writes into Call Talk, yes, at yahoo.com. He says, who gives a crap what you look like? You're kicking ass. People without ideas call names. It is true. I rarely, to the extent of almost never, get any substantive ideas from right-wingers that send messages. It's all just, you know, stuff like that. What was that one? Socialist liberal moron. That's what someone wrote. I mean, that's the nature. Or they write in, or sometimes they write in all caps. You piece of, you know, like that. You know, you're horrible. You, no arguments, just denunciations. Very weird. Anyway, this show, in terms of its ratings, is wildly popular. But as I've said before, I don't know if you've really caught this. This is not a talk show. So wait a minute. Opinionated talk show host calls for callers. Sounds like one. People get on the air. I say, hi, you're on the air. You get on the air, give your opinions. 313-298-WRIF. This is a public affairs show, and all media outlets have to stay in good standing with the Federal Communications Commission, has to do public service programming. That's what this is all about. So the fact that I talk about health care and the war and terrorism and racism and stuff like that, that fulfills it. I mean, they could just as easily, it was just the luck of the draw, just wound up with some lefty instead of a righty. It's just the way it turned out. So it doesn't even matter whether anyone's listening. We still have to do it because most public service programming is they have guests from the Histoplasmosis Foundation, right? You may have heard that if you're up golfing or working or something like that early on a Sunday morning, and they have people, and you know, Gaia bless them, that they're doing that kind of work, talking about this disease, histoplasmosis. I think maybe some of you in the medical profession, I think it's something like an asymptomatic lung ailment that most people in the South have. So I just always use that as a joke. And not hardly anyone listens except for the people that have histoplasmosis and the people in the Histoplasmosis Association. But like I say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Because they're fulfilling this public service requirement, actually. So I tell you this, too, that this show is very popular. The management here is very pleased with it. And one of the things that's occurred to me is that there are always calls that there. If you notice, once in a while, there's a couple people that are able to get through regularly. But we don't have a lot of regulars here because there's so many people dialing all at one time that it's hard to get through. And when I talk to people, they say, oh, I've always wanted to get on the air with you, but I can't get through. Because you may have 6 incoming lines, but if you have several hundred people trying to get them, it's like trying to win a contest on the radio. There's been a phenomenon. Ever since I've come back from Venezuela, remember I was down there for the World Social Forum in Caracas, the calls have really tapered off. Now, Dave, I don't want you to hang up. Dave from Westland is hanging on. And I raised two subjects. And I said, you can talk about anything you want, including Dave wants to talk about the Detroit Zoo controversy, and I'm interested in that. So please stay with it. That's it. There's no other callers. And the lowest thing that a talk show host can do is beg for calls. And to some extent, I am, well, a little bit I am, because I like to talk to you folks. But I can, you know that, I can ramble on. Yeah. If the phones were broke, you need 3 hours filled with me talking. Hey, I'm here. Yeah, this is what I do for a living. But I'm more interested and concerned why people aren't calling. I tend to think is that everything that was once controversial now has been borne out to this audience. I mean, how many more scandals can Bushco be exposed about? How much more can Bush and Cheney's ratings go down? I mean, if you saw, I mean, the only people that are left supporting Bush and Cheney and the war in Iraq and stuff like this is, and people that if they saw films of the two of them engaging in cannibalism, they would still support them. I mean, That's who it is. See, you get calls. Now all of a sudden, so if you're calling, Brandon is picking him up as quickly as he can. But, and I appreciate it. Now people are raising particular issues, but I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's just we won. Yeah. Bushco is down the drain. You know, the only problem is, folks, they're still in here. And even if we blow off these Republicans, and send them back to the corporations from which they came in this 2006. They're still going to be around till January 2007, and Bushco is going to be in there till 2009. Think about that. Just think about that. Well, all right, so we've got some callers, but this is weird. Coming up right away. In fact, there's lots of stuff happening around town. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com. Go to the calendar if you want to get involved in things. Because getting involved in things lets you express your ethical outrage about what's going on and also hooks you up in person with people. If you go to rallies and meetings and stuff like that. I mean, it's okay on the internet, but really getting out there and going to an event does it. So the entire week of March 15th to the 22nd is going to mark the third anniversary of Bush's war. Based on lies, absolutely unnecessary, created more of a problem than existed previously, resulted in the deaths of tens of thousands of people, including over 2,300 Americans, 15,000 or so hideously wounded Americans, and horribly wounded Iraqis. I just saw some, this kid has been brought to the United States. I was going to bring this here and read from it, but it had his photo on it. I couldn't even bear to look at it as he's so horribly disfigured. So there's going to be events. There's one in Northville. Imagine that. Downtown Northville at noon on this coming Saturday on the 18th. There's one in Ann Arbor on the 19th. They're in Battle Creek. There's one in downtown Detroit on the 18th. So if you want to express openly, publicly, which is the only way that it's going to be felt and people are going to realize this is going on. And you don't realize, you know, you look back on history and you see any number of events that changed America. You don't really know if you're involved in that. You could very well be. So, check out some of these things. And then when your grandkids say, what did you do to remove Bushco before 2009? You'll have some stories to tell them. All right, Peter Werby with you. Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. Since I brought up this issue of the teacher being suspended, let me ask some people. Here's Jim in Flint. Jim, hi, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Peter, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your show, and a couple things. But the people that respond to you, you know, negatively, right-wingers or whatever they are, think about this. They're listening to your show in order to respond. So, you know, what you're doing is you're stimulating creativity with your approach.
Oh, I'm glad they're listening. Yeah, I mean, they're Riff listeners. I mean, one of the things is, since this is a public affairs show, we want all the Riff listeners to listen, including the few left that are right-wingers.
That's right. I'd like to make a comment about the teacher. You know, I feel really bad for the teacher in a sense that they've made of an example of them. You know, the right wingers tried to make an example of them.
Yeah, it didn't work.
No, but when you think about it, are we really losing that much of our freedom of speech? And I see your point, and it's so strong. I had teachers in school that would do that. They would say something contradictory just to stimulate your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get you to respond, whether it was correct or incorrect, they got you thinking, and they were actually creative teachers, and they were really good teachers, you know. And I really feel bad about our educational system. They try and keep us down now, as far as the young people.
Yeah, it ain't the best anymore. Jim, did you ever have teachers that? I did. I probably most of us did that. We just couldn't stand what they were saying. I mean, that the opposite is there as well. And I didn't go report. It's not like I could go report to the school board and said, hey, this teacher, well, I had a teacher who's a member of this far right wing John Birch Society, and she was always running this stuff. It's not like I went to the school board and said, can you get rid of this teacher? Yeah. All right, Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate you calling. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see, here is Chris in White Lake. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? I was listening to you when you're talking about your educational friends and whatnot, how they're all on the left side and they never push their agenda when they're in their class or anything. They always try to put both sides and let people make a decision.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, they respect the kids, but I mean, they obviously have a point of view. But go ahead.
All right, I was going to say, you know, like when I went to school myself, I never got the other side. As a matter of fact, I didn't learn until I was over 18 years old what a Republican was, because through school I was always, it was a lot of the liberal stuff was pushed on me. The greatest president in the world was JFK, and I never understood why any of that was, and it was never pushed that way. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that most of your unions are liberal based, and the teachers are in a union, so it kind of makes it to where it's an unbiased situation, or it's a biased situation, because they have to push what they also believe in, which is their union. It's like my father when he worked for with GM, and they're unionized. They always told him, when you go out to vote, you better vote for our candidate, which is, you know, generally a Democrat.
Yeah, they advise people. I mean, certainly like a third of union homes vote Republican. Why, I never could understand. But what school did you go to, if I can ask?
I went to Lakeland High School out in White Lake. And, you know, like my godkids now, they go to school, and they haven't been taught the difference between the liberal or the Republican side either. I keep on saying liberal instead of Democratic, but Democratic instead of Republican side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like for in their age, their greatest president in the world is Clinton, obviously, and that's what was pushed. And, you know, so what I try to do with my godkids is I ask them, I say, well, what do you believe in when it comes down to abortion? And what do you believe in with legalization of drugs? And, you know, I try to ask them different questions, and I tell them, you know, what's your answers? You're, you know, probably about 75 this and 25% that kind of thing, and that's kind of where the stance is. But I also let them know that you don't always have to be one side, and I think that's something that has to happen in the schools more often so that we have it. More educated children growing up into a society of knowing which party they are more affiliated with. And one party that doesn't get pushed very much at all is the Libertarian. And,
well, you know, I mean, I know some Libertarians that are teachers.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things, unless these folks are lying to me, these friends of mine seem to be extraordinarily popular with their students, and sometimes they even tell me about they have debates with them. All right, Chris, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Dave in Westland, who's been waiting patiently. Dave, you wanted to talk about the Detroit Zoo?
Yes, I did. 24-year veteran caller to your show.
Oh, welcome. Wow.
This is MD.
MD.
Well, you remember the controversy that was brewing over the Detroit Zoo.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to say just one thing on that. I have to agree 100% with Al Brooks Patterson when he made the statement that these people on the Detroit City Council don't belong making decisions about the zoo. They belong in the zoo. That entire Kwame Kilpatrick administration is the biggest joke that the city of Detroit, and I grew up in Detroit, the biggest joke the city has ever, ever experienced. I can't believe they reelected this guy.
Well, you know, Kwame Kilpatrick is a interesting figure. On one hand, when you're in a city that has immense problems, you do tend to get people that, and I'm not making any judgments about Kilpatrick, but that you know, use it as a, you know, an easy way to attain. I don't know what he gets out of it. So I mean, we see. Let me erase all that. Get back to it. So we see these unseemly incidences that appear to be these small corruptions. But what this is all about and what's going on in Detroit is that it's lost its industrial base. It began losing its industrial base 50 years ago. None of the problems that it ever had was ever addressed. People used to blame it on Coleman Young, that somehow that he was responsible for what went on in Detroit. But and it's actually a very popular view that Coleman Young was the cause of everything, and somehow they Dennis Archer, no one ever talks about him. He was a nice guy, you know. But now you have this flamboyant Kilpatrick. Well, as it turns out, housing starts are more than they've been in a long time. More businesses and restaurants are opening. There's been a lot of improvements to downtown that haven't occurred in 20 or 25 years. But that barely touches what's wrong with Detroit. You have a population that's not waged well enough to create a tax base. You have industry that decided to abandon the city, and instead go to the first, initially, 50 years ago, to the south where they could get non-union wages, and finally to places like Mexico and other areas where they, you know, could cut costs. And then they blame the people that are left. Now, I was at a Borders where people were talking about this book. What the hell was it? I did it because I interviewed the author. Can't remember it. Anyway, So someone out of nowhere says the symbol of Detroit's destruction is that fist downtown Detroit. And I said, are you kidding? It should be banks and auto companies would be a monument to the destruction of Detroit. But in the popular suburban imagination, that somehow it was these projection of black nationalism or militancy that ruined Detroit, rather than seeing that that barely is a footnote in it all. That it all had to do with the way that capitalism blesses some places at certain times, some countries, some regions. One south always used to be this backwater, this area that was economically deprived, in Detroit and Pittsburgh and Youngstown and all these places now that are not doing very well were the high points. So it's like the capitalist wheel of misfortune, and to blame it on Kwame Kilpatrick as he buys his wife some Lincoln Navigator, it just really misses it. Because I'll tell you, I mean, I was talking with somebody. I was playing handball with these guys. We started up this thing, Coleman Young. Coleman Young ruined Detroit. He said, how did he do that? He said, when he told white people to go north of 8 Mile Road, I said, whew, man. I can't even believe you've distorted reality that much. Coleman Young, when he came in, found the city that was run by whites, had a brutal white police chief, had a white mayor, actually was a liberal and what have you, and the dominant political and economic figures were all white. But there was this immense crime problem. Crack was prevalent. Gangs were prevalent. And he said something like, that lawbreakers should hit the road, go north of 8 Mile Road. What he meant was get out of town. And then people freaked, oh, he's telling all these black gangs to come to Oakland County. Oh, I mean, it was rubbish. I mean, it wasn't well stated. What he was saying, what he should have said, I'm going to be tough on crime. I'm going to eliminate crime, but in a non-racist, fair way. So they said, they kind of looked at me. Well, you know, when you contradict myth, people don't buy it. I mean, they have nothing to back it up. So they said, well, no, it was Coleman Young. And I said, well, you already said that. But I said, could you show me any single analysis by anyone, any liberal, conservative, middle of the road, anyone who blames policies, economic policies of the Young administration for the what's happened in Detroit? Well, it doesn't exist. And in the same manner, Kwame Kilpatrick, who probably should have been turned out just because these small corruptions are, they shouldn't be allowed. But, hey, you don't live there, I don't live there. And I got to do some spots talking about capitalism. We'll be right back.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tune for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'll be airing a couple of interviews. At 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time, it'll be with the founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And at 1, with a guy who was turned out to be a zany interview. His name is it Keith or Kent? I can't remember. Anyways, a couple of twins that co-author books with famous people. Like, they have one famous one with John Lydon, and with Sonny Barger, founder of Hell's Angel, the Hell's Angels. They've done a few books with him. This one is with David Hilliard, who is chief of staff at the Black Panther Party. And I couldn't get him right away, so I'm actually going to interview him later, Hilliard. So I got this kind of bizarre interview, but I think you'll enjoy it. 1 a.m. Okay, well, here's something good if you're rich, I guess. The number of billionaires around the world rose by 102 last year to a record 793. Their combined wealth grew 18% to $2.6 trillion. So about 800 people are sitting on $2.6 trillion. You ready for that? I mean, in some ways, it didn't matter. I mean, that's more money. Let me see. Some of these people, they had like $28 billion, $23 billion. Oh, yeah. Bill Gates, still the world's richest man. $46 billion. He's up to $50 billion from $46. Warren Buffett, his fortune fell to $42 billion. So they've got these billions of dollars that come out to be $2.6 trillion. And what goes on here as a result of that is this enormous starvation across the world. This wealth that is produced, I mean, you don't, your wealth is produced, I mean, well, I don't know, it's kind of involved. But everybody produces wealth by the work that we do throughout the world, except that some people are rewarded extraordinarily, in fact, insanely, if you think about it. Why would somebody have $45 billion? Why wouldn't you have this funneled so this was spread more equitably, so we didn't have children starving to death? If you know, I rarely try to pull on people's heartstrings, although I should. It should be about our hearts. It shouldn't be about our pocketbooks or even our intellect, but ultimately we ought to be driven by our heartstrings. And on my website, peterwerby.com, there's a photograph of a starving kid. And this is directly related to this enormous amount of wealth. I mean, there's X amount of wealth in the world. It's like if there was $100 and there's 10 of us, and we could either give $10 to each of us, or we could give $90 to two of us, and the rest of us would split $10. Well, that's what's going on now. So that creates mass starvation, mass disease. These scenes of such squalor in these cities throughout Africa and Latin America and Asia, even countries that are trying to help the poor, like in Venezuela where I was, and the slums in Caracas, I mean, they're shocking. They're shocking when you're 5 feet away. They look bad when you see them on television, but when you're right there, it's terrible. And these are people that are beginning to move up, because what's happening is Chavez is taking the money that normally would just go to the rich people in Venezuela and distributing it more among the poor. So 90%, well, I don't know, I don't think it was that bad, but that at least 50% of the people were poor. So that doesn't have to be, because all you got to do is get a better deal from the multinationals that invest there, and rather than siphoning it all up to the people that already have the money, you give it to the people that really need it. And they don't need it for luxuries. They need it for a nutritious diet. They need it for simple medical concerns. They need it for basic education. But the fact that it's not happening around the world, and it's getting worse, I think I've mentioned this article before. You can go online and get it. It might even be somewhere on my website. But it's called Planet of Slums. Planet of Slums by Mike Davis. In fact, I would recommend reading Mike Davis anything, any book by Mike Davis. He's an essayist mainly, so you get like a collection of his essays. City of Quartz, about Los Angeles, Dead Cities. He writes about cities. And it's not pretty, and it's getting worse. I just talked to a friend that came back from Colombia, where she's from. And she talked about the fact with the penetration of U.S. agricultural goods into Colombia, that it's worsening an already horrible situation in that country. And what's happening now is that our beans are going into a country that was used to produce it all itself. So bean farmers are being the bean farms are going out of business, and the farmers then are coming into the big cities like Medellin and the Bogota, which are already horror shows. And just like in Caracas, where I was, I don't know what's happening there exactly, but it goes from they don't even know how many people are there. They tried to do a census, it didn't work. 5 to 7 million people crammed into this fairly small space. Same thing in Mexico. We import U.S. corn. It destroys subsistent corn farming and small farming, small communities based on corn farming. And these people then go to Mexico City. So what is there now, 23 million or something like that? What's the solution there? I don't even know if there is one. But it has to do, in good part, with the way that the wealth of the world is distributed. If you go from a capitalist model, even, I mean, there's different ways that capitalism functions. And what we're looking at now is the absolute worst way. The absolute worst way. So that you have 793, mostly men, benefiting incredibly. And on the other hand, you have a billion people minimum that are doing horrible, that you and I couldn't imagine living like, no matter what your economic circumstances are, if you're listening, couldn't imagine living like this billion people do. So, and I don't know how these people live with themselves. I know some of them, you know, like Gates does philanthropical work and what have you, but it's not that. It's not about whether, I mean, most of these guys are hogs. You know, they just want this as a symbol of their wealth, because you can't consume anywhere near the kind of wealth that that they hold. I mean, I wish I could get a URL. There is Manuel, who listens on the internet, who sent me this these shots. Let me see. Actually, I'm looking at it right here. I mean, it's the most horrible thing that I can. Whoa! Oh, this wasn't. Where the hell did this go? Made by great. Anyways, it's I forgot where it is. One of these Arab Emirates, where this guy lives in like a 40,000 square foot house. So I mean, it's like a hotel. He's got like 20 Rolls Royces. He's got a BMW made out of silver. I mean, this is the level at which consumption, what would you call it? This grotesque consumption of way beyond needs, way beyond comfort, way beyond even ostentatious consumption. And I don't even know what it becomes. In the meantime, there's this kid on my website with his ribs showing, enough to make you cry. And there, probably if you took 10 or 20% of this wealth and used it to feed people, which isn't the solution, but again, it's very complicated, how poverty results. But just the act of doing that could be accomplished in a manner that none of these people would, their lifestyle would be touched in the slightest. Oh, here's the Neil Bush thing. Investors from the United Arab Emirates helped fund the $23 million Neil Bush, I said Marvin, didn't I? Neil Bush raised for Ignite, the learning systems company that holds lucrative No Child Left Behind Act contracts in Florida and Texas. So it's all a racket, right? It's all a total racket. That's what's going on here. So we have the president's brother delivering the 2000 election to him to begin with. And on his other brother gets $23 million with investments from the United Arab Emirates. These are the ports guys, and he gets these lucrative contracts from this act that Bush and the Republicans put through, and they're in Florida and in Texas. Neil Bush's frequent travels to Dubai are documented by Data Matrix, a Dubai-based information technology company that has featured Neil Bush as a speaker. When people like that go to speak, when Papa Bush goes, they get like, I can't remember. I was going to say $50,000. I think it's much more than that. Maybe $1 million, but somebody maybe remind me. The Data Matrix website features several prominent photographs of Neil Bush addressing a Dubai conference, identifying Neil Bush as the brother of U.S. President George Bush. Remember, Neil Bush was the director of the failed Silverado Savings and Loan It collapsed in a scandal that ultimately cost you and I, the taxpayers, $1 billion for his role in the savings and loan debacle. Neil Bush was fined and permanently banned from further activities in banking. In a messy divorce ending a 23-year-old marriage with Sharon Bush, the mother of his children, Neil Bush gave a deposition in which he admitted multiple sex romps with Oriental prostitutes. Oriental, that's weird. Asian should be. During his many, quote, business trips to Asia. So I don't know. Weapons sales are $1 trillion a year, too. That's sweet. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby here with you. And let's see. Let's go to Bill. Bill, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Where are you calling from? Hey, Bill. Bill? You're asleep. You can't have that. All right. So, I mean, you're going to... All right. Here's a caller from Roseville. You're on the air. What's your first name?
My name's Chris.
Chris, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I have to say I was rather disappointed lately with the passage of the Patriot Act.
Yeah?
Disappointed that it was so overwhelmingly passed in both House of Reps and the Senate.
Well, fortunately, Senator Carl Levin voted against it. The always dubious, what's her name, Debbie Stabenow,
yeah,
voted for it.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with Carl Levin. Sandra Levin voted for it, too.
Did he?
In the House of Reps, yep. But, I mainly call to talk about the subject of politics in the classroom, particularly with teachers pushing them.
Sure.
And my experience, I haven't had many teachers push them on me. I've had a lot of government teachers. Right now I'm a senior at Roseville High School.
Uh-huh.
In Roseville, Michigan.
Right, sure.
And I've noticed a majority of teachers are pretty left-wing when it comes to teaching government.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite teachers, Miss Milligan, she's a real good teacher. I noticed that a lot of students, even though if a teacher does push their viewpoints heavily on students, even in middle school, typically students just they aren't interested in what the teachers have to say regarding that.
Well, you would think if they were, just like I had these conservative teachers always trying to shove the super patriotic stuff down my throat.
Yeah, I know about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay any attention to them. But the ones that would really open up discussion and debate. But I don't know. I don't know how you can, you have to have some political opinion. And so to have a, quote, objective teacher is, I don't even know if that's possible.
Yeah, I think it's hard just to have a truly objective person.
Sure, yeah. All right, Chris, thank you very much. What we're talking about is this Denver teacher from the Detroit area who went to Seaholm in Birmingham, got suspended because this little Nazi youth student, he recorded his lecture and then took it to these right-wing talk show hosts who played parts of it on the talk show. I mean, he's trying to get rid of them. That was the idea. He wasn't trying to open up debate. All right, let's try Bill one more time. Bill, are you there? Bill, you're not getting it, are you? All right. He is gone, although he wanted to talk about this demonstration against the Canadian seal slaughter that's about to commence. And there's a demonstration on Wednesday. If you'd like to find out about it, go to my website, Peter Werby, PeterWerbe.com. Let's see. Here's Hayes in Ann Arbor. Hayes, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'm so glad to talk to you. Thank you for answering my call.
Sure. Glad to.
Well, you know, the right wing has been obfuscating morality for a long time now.
Sure.
And I would like to see them exercise the morality code of gluttony.
Of what? Of gluttony?
Gluttony is a big no-no.
Yeah.
And I'm in a position to see the interiors of homes of some of the folks who are huge on consumerism. And there are rooms full of plastic toys, cheap stuff, and the whole point is to buy lots of cheap stuff. They don't want to pay for anything, when just paying a little bit more for some of the goods that they buy would make sure that people actually have enough to eat this country.
I'm not following this.
Well, there was a time, and I don't want to be a reversal, type of person. But there was a time when people could actually afford, even people who weren't very wealthy, could afford to pay for their goods, maybe not so many of them, but they could buy a leather coat or a nice purse or whatever. And they were consumers and enjoyed their products that they bought. But it has become this thing where these huge homes are just filled with knickknacks and crap and toys that mean nothing, that are thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
And children are not learning a thing from the types of things that they buy, except that they should be consumers.
Well, that ultimately is the message. All right, Hayes, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Here is Gary in Detroit. Gary, hi. You're on the air. You're on Night Call. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to your pal Macho Dave from Westland. I don't understand why everybody out in the suburbs sees fit to tell us how to run the city, but they didn't even know, they would balk at the very idea that I would say, come out to Westland and tell them how to run that, or worse, go someplace like Warren and tell them to stop having fist fights at the city council meeting.
Yeah.
It's amazing the way everybody sees fit. I don't like throwing the word racism around a lot, but I don't see people in Warren telling people in Westland how to run this city. Everybody just sees fit to tell Detroit. The simple fact of the matter is the zoo deal was a bad deal, and Kwame Kilpatrick walked into the city council. He gave them the deal, said, I'm going out of town, have this passed by the time I got back. He didn't see fit to answer any questions and left us with a bunch of bills for a zoo that we would no longer have control over. Yes, Barbara Rose Collins is probably insane, and she makes a lot of stupid comments. That's why the Democratic Party yanked her out of Congress and stuck her someplace they figured she couldn't do a whole lot of harm.
Mm-hmm.
We have a strong mayor form of government in Detroit. But simple fact of the matter is, why in the world somebody calls himself Macho Dave sees fit to tell us how to run our city, I will never understand.
Do you have any thoughts about the fact that suburbanites refer to the mayors by their first name?
Sure, that's just flat-out racism. It was a constant practice in the South that you would call black people by their first name, but white people had to be called Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think to some extent there was within the African American community there was an affectionate use of and sort of a familiarity of use of the first name, but it goes back to a lot of ways of speaking that may be all right for some people but not for others, which I agree with actually.
Yeah, but I think a lot of white people intentionally do it to be disrespectful. They intentionally leave the man's title off.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's nobody. I mean, you wouldn't call what the hell? You don't refer to the mayor of New York as Michael or the mayor of Chicago. Why can't as Richard, right? But somehow Kwame and Coleman seem to be okay. Yeah,
They did it with Giuliani in New York. You don't even call him Rudy all the time. But
you're right. Okay, there you go.
But I mean that was done affectionately.
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, that's what I mean. Well, that's what I mean. Within the black community, to call Coleman Young Coleman, because that's one thing. When suburbanites referred to him as Coleman, I mean, that's what these guys were telling me in this gym. They said, well, Coleman, you know, screwed up everything. I'm saying, in fact, I said to him, I said, oh, did you know him? And they said, what? I mean, they didn't even get it.
Of course, I get that all the time. My sister's boyfriend, he didn't even live in this city till about 10 years ago. And he's sitting around lecturing me on how Coleman Young ran the city into the ground. We didn't even live here 10 years when Coleman Young was in there. I'm not even sure if he was even alive when Coleman Young was in office.
Well, you have to, I mean, here's the deal, Gary. If you begin to look at the structural problems of the city, and look at the economics of it, well, then you have to start really indicting the powerful figures and the powerful forces in our society. If you can blame it on, quote, Coleman, you can just continue along in your little daydream that you construct. You know what I mean?
But the implication is always that this place is such a paradise. From top to the last day white people were running it, then all of a sudden it became this horrible hellhole the day after the city became black. When in fact, as early as 1958, this city was heading downhill.
No, that's right. That's what I said. It's been, they really mark the economic, downspin in 50 years ago or so. All right, Gary, I want to thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good one. Bye now. Yeah, I mean, come on. And that's, and if you don't, for one thing, I want you to call 313-298-WRIF, but don't call up and embarrass yourself and say something stupid about this, because what you really have to say, it, in fact, what Gary was saying, is show that somehow things were okay, and then Coleman Young, Mayor Coleman Young, got in and through specific policies undercut the economic vibrant quality of the city. You can't do it. And like I said, no one even suggests that in any real sense. It's just this stupid, unrealistic way that people try to explain things that that they're too fearful to go for the real answer, I think. All right, let's continue on. Here's Terry in Dearborn. Terry, hi, it's Peter Werby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. I want to pick your brain a little bit here. Now, I realize you've already enlightened us with tons of information. For that, I thank you.
Oh.
But I do have two questions. They're both about energy and money, but they're completely unrelated. First one's about Iran and them selling oil by with the euro dollar. I heard it was supposed to happen this month.
I have two. That's what I hear. I mean, some people have said that's what sealed Saddam Hussein's fate, the fact that he was going to switch from the euro... from the petrodollar to the euro to the, it's hard to say, from the petrodollar to the petro euro, which would have devalued the U.S. dollar considerably and could have created a run on it. I mean, if you think about it, the United States is a debtor nation, and the idea that the dollar is the dominant currency of the world ain't the way that everybody sees it anymore. But I mean, if that was to happen, I mean, this economy could conceivably come unraveled.
Yeah, I believe that that's one major reason they did invade Iraq as well. That's why I'm really concerned about this and what it'll do to our economy. Not that I really care what the rich people, what happens to them, but I guess I'll go on to my second question.
Well, let me just say before okay. Say that, Terry, is that they always land on their feet. I mean, they took some hits, like, say, I was talking about this, I think, last week, during the Great Depression. But there still was a class of rich people, and where you see these photographs of the Dust Bowl and these soup lines in the big cities and shut factories. These rich people were having, you know, they were buying big old Packard 12-cylinder convertibles, and they were having big parties out in Grosse Pointe and what have you. I mean, some of them took a hit, but most of them, they just continued on.
That's right. Look what happened since Bush has taken over. Every single disaster has just been a big windfall for the rich people.
Well, he's the master of disaster, as
exactly.
We say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The next disaster, my theory is, I guess my question is about the natural gas prices and how much they've gone up in such a short period of time.
Yeah.
My theory is this is the Enron/Mafia scheme that they used on California, they're using on us here, because it can't cost any, the ground doesn't charge for natural gas, so it can't cost them any more to harvest out of the ground. And there's no shortage. After Katrina, a couple months later, after they raised the price, they admitted there's no shortage. They have enough stockpile months ago for the whole winter. So, and nobody talks about this, Peter. And quadrupled in 5 years, and it's like no stories, no mention in the press.
Yeah, I think there has been mention. And one of the things that these robber barons do is they look to see how are people reacting? How do people react to this rise in prices? Well, now gas is up to many places. I saw one coming into work, $2.55. And if they start squawking a little, like, oh, we better get down to about $2.20 or something like that. And the same thing with the gas. If there's no reaction and they can just pick our pockets all the more, increase, in other words, this is transfer of wealth. We work. And are we going to pay X amount per cubic foot of natural gas and per gallon of gasoline? And if it's one price, we have more. We retain more of the wealth we produce for purchases we prefer. Or can they gouge us to the point where they make more money? So it's a competition for where this wealth is going to wind up. I mean, the same thing that's what I was talking about earlier. This huge amount of wealth is transferred from us, what we produce, to these huge war corporations, all connected into Bushco, and both in terms of destroying countries like Iraq and then rebuilding countries of Iraq, although nothing gets rebuilt, does it? So it's all this enormous racket, and we have not found the agency, the institution, or the method through which we can, as a people, that we can confront this. And because we know we're getting ripped off, we know we're getting robbed, because there's no reason that if the price at the oil at the pump head in Saudi Arabia goes up, well, then it would go up correspondingly, and they would continue to make the same profit, the oil companies say. But the fact that they've made extraordinary profits means they're raising the price at the gasoline pump way beyond what it's costing them. And the same thing's true with natural gas. And the fact that there are no consequences to them politically or economically or anything like that, they figure, what the hell? I mean, if they were good, decent people, they would feel guilty and they'd say, well, let's see if we can get this natural gas or this gasoline to people as cheaply as we can, because we know that the people that ultimately get hurt the most in situations like this are the poorer people and the poorer working class people. It's not going to affect somebody who's making $200,000 a year if gasoline goes up or natural gas prices go up. So we want to do the decent thing. Well, this is not what motivates them, and they don't function out of decency. As we see, this $2.6 trillion is parked in the hands of 793 people, while other people starve to death, massive disease, hideous cities, no medical care, and stuff like that. So there's only one way that ever has altered the manner in which these people function, and that's force. Ooh, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? But what I mean by that is they have to be forced to be decent human beings. There's some, like, if there were no laws, I wouldn't murder anyone. Terry, you wouldn't murder anyone. 98% of the people wouldn't murder anyone. They don't need a law against murder to stop them. But there's 2% of the population that is just plain nuts and mean, that are forestalled from carrying out their worst evil fantasies of rage and revenge and all that by the fact that there's laws. They know if they kill somebody that they're mad at, they're going to spend the rest of their life in jail here in Michigan. So they have to be restrained from acting out their worst impulses by force. The oil companies need to be have the same thing done to them. And these 793 billionaires that create by their greed, by their willingness to take the wealth of the world and put it into the hands of themselves, which they don't even use. Not like they consume with it. You and I want more money because we want to consume more things, like a cottage up north. We'd like a, you know, nicer car, something like that. You know, we want to buy stuff. They can't buy stuff with $45 billion. What they could buy was food for the people that are starving. But these lousy son of a bitches are so greedy that they're not going to do it. So they have to be forced. It's pure and simple. All right. Thank you. Let's see. Here's Bill. Bill's going to give it another try. Bill?
Hi.
Okay. You're going to do better this time.
It's actually Daryl. That's why I didn't know you were talking to me.
Well, I got you listed as Bill again.
Yeah. It's just calling to inform everybody that Wednesday, March 15th, marks the opening day of the annual brutal Canadian seal slaughter, harp seal slaughter. And an international day of action has been scheduled. It's protests around the world. There will be one right here in Detroit. It's actually a simultaneous demonstration with folks over in Windsor. And it will be downtown out in front of the entrance to the tunnel, out in front of the Mariners Church at 4:30, and it will go until 6:30.
Good.
And we will be with two purposes to it. One is just to raise awareness of the public that this seal slaughter is still going on.
Yeah, because it had been stopped, right?
Actually, it hadn't been stopped. It had been curtailed down quite a bit. I think it got as low as 40,000. And that was actually done. It's kind of an interesting thing, it backfired on the animal rights organizations that at one time they were killing what's known as white coats, the cute little white babies that everybody sees. And a law was pushed through, actually it was law pushed through to ban the killing of these white coats.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what happened was at that point, it was kind of assumed that the hunt was done, because if they couldn't kill white coats, they wouldn't be able to sell the pelts. Actually, they kind of had a moratorium. They brought the number way down, and then they started finding other uses for seal products. For example, now they have seal oil capsules.
Oh, great.
Omega-3. Literally, the Canadian government went out and formed new markets because it's perpetuating the slaughter. And now it's back with a vengeance. Last year, 320,000 seal pups were killed.
And these are little pups. They're the cutest thing in the world. And these guys go out with clubs. And these seal, these harp seal pups are not even afraid. And these guys go up and smash their brains out.
Well, it's not even that they're not afraid. Some of them are as little as 12 days old. As I said, they're not allowed to kill white coats, but after about 12 days, what happens is the coat starts to change. The white downy fur begins to fall off. And they can kill what's called a raggedy coat. They can kill a pup that has the slightest little bit of black on it.
Uh-huh.
Still only 12 days old. The Canadian government is playing semantics with this and saying, well, they're not babies because they're no longer white coats, but 12 days old, cannot swim, has not eaten solid food, can't get away from these sealers, and they're killed in two ways.
Well, let me do this, Daryl. Actually, I have to take a break right now, but let me say that the whole story, both how horrible this is and the unconscionable involvement of the Canadian government, is available at seashepherd.org, right?
Seashepherd.org.
Seashepherd.org. I don't give money to a lot of organizations. I give some to this. And if you want the information about, if you didn't get all that Daryl was telling you about this coming Wednesday, what is it, 4:30, did you say?
4:30, yes.
4:30 in front of the Windsor-Detroit Tunnel. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and go to the calendar, and that'll give you all the details. So, Daryl, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Peter.
All right, bye now. And also, remember, I was saying this is coming up, third anniversary of Bush's criminal war against Iraq, and that'll give you all the demonstrations. Or if you're not listening in Detroit or in Michigan, you can go to unitedforpeace.org, unitedforpeace.org, find out where there's demonstrations happening in your area. We'll be right back, 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
visiting WRIF.com.
On 101WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Stay tuned right up till 1 a.m. I have a couple of great interviews for you, including one with the founder of Iraq Vets Against the War, and another kind of wacky one with a twin brother, one of a pair of twin brothers who writes with famous people. In this case, the founder. One of the founders of the Black Panther Party, David Hilliard. All right, let's go back to our phones and pick up Rich in Detroit. Rich, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hey, Rich, you with
me?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I heard you talking about Coleman Young earlier, and I was kind of curious about your opinion with him.
Well, I don't know. He was a guy. I don't know what to say. Maybe. I don't think anything that he or any other mayor could have done at a particular time could have dealt with the economic slide. Coleman Young, like Kwame Kilpatrick, has this flamboyant side to him that rubs like white people the wrong way. On the other hand, there was Dennis Archer, who was this model of comportment, and things kept going to hell under him as well because he had no capacity to do anything any differently, even though he like Coleman Young, had the ear of the auto magnates and the rich. There was just nothing that could be done. But nobody has anything bad to say about Dennis Archer, although that was part of the slide as well. Coleman Young, I don't know. I mean, the situation is bad, and there was nothing that Coleman Young could do there. Right now, I don't think there's anything that Kwame Kilpatrick should do. I mean, he ought to comport himself in a manner that doesn't bring the kind of criticism down, unnecessarily down on him. But politicians are prone to small personal corruptions. I mean, if you think about, for instance, people are saying, you know, he got his wife this Lincoln Navigator. Bill Frist, who's head of the Republicans in the Senate, there. Gee, I wish I had this website off the top of my head. I mean, like Tom DeLay and all the rest of these criminals in Congress, they're just living the life of Riley, staying at $1,000 a night hotels. They get free this and free that, and you don't hear a word of it. You don't hear a word of it. I don't know. What do you think about him?
Well, I believe that somebody that's in Washington, D.C. is much different than somebody who is in a small town like Detroit. There is less than a million people now in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a family relative that, well, he ran against Coleman Young back in 79 or 80, and he was much different back then.
Who was? Coleman Young?
The entire city.
Yeah, well, like I say, it's the slide has continued. The wheel of misfortune is pointing at us now. I mean, you have, like I said at the beginning of the show, you have General Motors closing plants, these supplier plants in real trouble, and here you have Kia saying, "Hey, we're going to spend $1 billion to build an automobile plant in Georgia."
His office in general. Such as Young Boys Incorporated. Coleman Young was pointed as being one of the directors of Young Boys Incorporated.
Rich,
way back when.
Rich, you're talking such nonsense. I told you and other people, don't call up and embarrass yourself, and that's what you're doing. I'm not even continuing. People, see you later. Young Boys Incorporated was this crack cocaine syndicate. Very inventive. These were the brightest and the best people that had they lived in the suburbs could have probably become real estate magnates, isn't that the word? But people that don't have access to the normal job market, in sociological terms, what they do, they innovate. They innovate. People that are not allowed in. I mean, that's why initially you had Italian gangsters and Jewish gangsters and what have you. They eventually were absorbed into the larger white society. That still hasn't been afforded completely to people of African ancestry. So that's the cause of crime. I mean, poverty, for one thing. And you still have bright, innovative, aggressive people that, okay, we can't do what is available to the mainstream. We'll create this. All right, let's go on to, but really, don't embarrass yourself. Know what you're talking about. Don't just repeat stupid myths and stuff like that. Here's Chris in Harrison Township. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter, how you doing?
Doing great.
That's good. Yeah, call to talk about Bush, and among all the terrible things that are going on right now, I mean, of course, we got Iraq and Katrina and the wiretrapping scandal and the Cheney shooting, and they've handled themselves terribly on everything. But what really worries me is what they're not talking about. And among the things that they're not talking about is the deficit.
Wow,
right,
man.
Now.
Yeah, and it just went another record. Let me just real quickly say the deficit is, it's one of us maxing out on their credit card. You're going to be paying high interest rates, and you've essentially hocked your future earnings to the bank. In the case of the United States, it means those of you, the younger you are, the more you're going to be, your taxes are going to be paying debt service to foreign banks who are essentially now financing the United States. That's the major scandal, and these incompetent criminals in Washington don't care.
Apparently not, because from what I heard recently, that now Bush, since he's been in, the current Bush, he is now, and this sounds like an old favorite song from the 80s, but he's now contributed as much to the national debt as all the other presidents combined. They used to say that during the Reagan years, where every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter had come up with a little less than $1 trillion debt. I mean, in all that time, in that more than approximately 200 years, they had contributed about going on $1 trillion. And then Reagan and Bush Sr. contributed another $4 trillion on top of that. And now this current Bush has contributed more than the $5 trillion, which is just incredible. I mean, it seems to me that they're going to have to do something serious soon, like a major tax increase or serious tampering with Social Security and Medicare.
I don't even think that'll do it. The deficit is so high, and you can't keep fighting these wars and draining the economy, jobs going overseas. You have most, the whole 20th century was about the U.S. investing either having capital penetration of other countries. Now, it's the reverse is happening. Now, a lot of these corporations have joint ventures with, like, Dubai. I mean, there is a whole sort of underground, unspoken part of this ports deal where any number of big U.S. corporations were lobbying very quietly to let this ports deal go because they're in thrall to these United Arab Emirates themselves.
Sure. Like you were saying that Bush's own brother is one of the big beneficiaries.
Yeah. And to some extent, we were talking about sort of personal corruption, both on the part of the Bush family and on the part of the United Arab Emirates. But the bigger picture is, what are we talking about? Billions of investments that have these little autocratic, nasty, anti-Semitic police states, authoritarian-run Emirates, suddenly are the financial partners of these big American companies, and all of a sudden they love the United Arab Emirates. All right, thank you, Chris. You're right, and people aren't yelling about it. I mean, people were so upset, understandably, we're talking about Detroit, about the high crime rate, because you'd walk out of a bar and someone would stick a gun in your face and say, "Give me your money or I'm going to kill you." And you'd pull out $60 or $70 and give it to the person, and you were enraged that this would happen. Understandably, that's chump change, nothing, zero, compared to how we're being looted. So what's happening is the wealthy are gaining extraordinary amount of wealth, as we see this huge increase in the amount of billionaires in the United States. We're paying the freight, because when we start talking about repaying the debt that Bush Co. has run up, who the hell do you think is paying it? So instead of it going to schools and roads and making a wonderful cities and paying people decent wages and what have you, it's going off to the foreign banks from which Bush Co. borrowed money in order for the United States to make war. So in other words, they're going to borrow money from a bank in China. It's going to go through the United States. It's going to go to, like, the Carlyle Group or any one of these weapons manufacturers. Iraq gets destroyed. Halliburton gets the contract. Then these banks have to be repaid. Well, where does the money come from any government? It comes from the taxpayers. So we're essentially paying off loans that have come from Chinese banks through to Bush's family and friends. And, we're going, "Oh, yeah, it's terrible." Well, I'm not faulting you. I think I mentioned last week about somebody who told me that nobody cares. And I said, well, I don't want to say his name. I mean, he's a DJ here. You might know who he is. Now, you would. And I said, well, other people might think you don't care because there's no external manifestation of your opposition to what's going on. And as I keep saying, it's real hard. There's no opposition party. But we've got to make do with what we have. I was just here listening to Patti Smith coming in singing, "People Have the Power." And ultimately we do. Except we have to exercise it. And I know you're saying, like, how do I do it? How do I do it? What do I do tomorrow? But we have to begin. I don't know, because what I think will happen as we move along, it will figure out what to do. Should it be impeachment? Should it just be 100 million people in the street saying, "Bush, get out of office"? I mean, that's how many, he's screwing like 250 million people or 275 million people for the benefit of about 25 million people. And we're eating it. So get out to these demonstrations. Get out to these rallies and community meetings. Find out what's going on. If you're just going to listen, I mean, this can be part of it, and you listening and calling and thinking about it is part of it. I'm not trying to demean this, or I'm not trying to demean your individual discomfort or rage or anger or whatever, but eventually it's got to coalesce in an extraordinarily human way, because they're counting on us being separate individuals, sitting and watching Fox News and either accepting it all, the poor, pathetic people that do that, or sitting there and thinking, "That's a lie. That's BS. I don't believe that. That doesn't work. That's not going to do anything." In fact, you'd do well to turn it off and read a book. All right, let's go, wow, way out Grand River to Fowlerville. Hey, how you doing, Mike? You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call, sir.
Sure, glad to.
I just want to talk about that teacher real quick.
Yeah, the one out in Denver. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I feel as if there should be no religion in schools. There should also be no political discussions in the schools also. He wasn't teaching government. He was giving his opinion. And if he wants to give his opinion, he should get a talk radio just like you have.
I thought he wasn't. What was he teaching?
Geography.
Was it geography class?
Yes.
Well, that's one of the arguments. I mean, it depends. I mean, we don't, in a lot of ways, So what if it was like a social studies class?
Well, as long as he teaches about the government and not gives his opinion, that's fine with me.
Well, where should, I don't know, how do you not give your opinion? I mean, when you have a politically charged era like we have.
Well, you're right about that. It's very hard, as we both know. But like I say, if you're going to take on the position of a teacher, and there should be no discussion of religion, there should be no discussion of politics, you shouldn't be able to give your opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Mike. Mike says no opinion. Just tell the facts, whatever the hell those are. Let's see. Let's go to James in Westland. James, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Well, I hear a lot of complaints on this show. And, well, I want to try to bring up a solution.
Sure.
I remember about a couple weeks back you were talking about ethanol.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You said that EA5... You can't really get a lot of it because, like, there's only so much corn in America.
Yeah.
Well, what if you can get ethanol or some type of usable alternative fuel from grass?
Well, any biomass.
Well, I mean, think about it like this. What's in your front lawn? What's in your back
Weeds.
Lawn?
Weeds.
Weeds.
Some grass.
Grass.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So what if you mow your lawn every week that, you know, you can actually go out there and mow your lawn. Okay, you take a couple bags of it to the corner. Okay?
Well, let me say this, because we're almost near the end of the show. You're on to something, James. I don't know if that's exactly the way to do it, but what you're talking about is a mass and community-wide approach to deal with what we're facing. And that's extraordinarily important. What you're saying may or may not be what is exactly the way to go, but conceptually it is. So I appreciate that. In fact, I have to say my apologies to the rest of you. This is going to have to be the last call because we got to go to spots, and then we'll be back with the interviews. Thanks for calling. We'll do it again next week.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. If you went back into Detroit 36 years ago, you might see signs, graffiti, headlines in Fifth Estate, the underground newspaper, saying, Free Huey, Free Huey. I'm not sure some of you old-timers will remember what that's all about. A lot of you won't. We have an author with us that's going to tell us all about it. The book is called Huey, Spirit of the Panther. It's written by David Hilliard. David Hilliard was one of the founders of the Black Panthers, along with Huey Newton, who the book is about, and also was the Black Panther Chief of Staff. And the book is written with Keith and Kent Zimmerman. And joining me is Kent Zimmerman. Kent, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
How's it going, Peter?
It's going great. Thanks for joining us here in Detroit. Where are you? You're out in, like, Oakland?
I'm in Oakland.
Oakland. All right. Well,
I just put aside
something I was going to read from, but I can flip to the back of this. The two of you, it's your brother, right, Keith
and
Ken?
Yeah, we're actually twin brothers.
Really? Okay.
Pretty strange.
you're the co-authors of the international bestseller, Rotten, No Irish, No Blacks, No Dogs, which is about former Sex Pistol frontman Johnny Lydon, known, of course, everywhere as Johnny Rotten. Sing My Way Home, Voices of the New American Roots Rock, the New York Times bestseller Hell's Angel, The Life and Times of Sonny Barger and the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club, right out there in Oakland. No wonder. Did you have to write this? Did Sonny Barger demand that you write this? Or?
Yeah, my mother always says, why can't you work with nice people? And I tell her I do. They're all nice people.
Let's clear up something right away. The title, Rotten, No Irish, No Blacks, No Dogs, is, I mean, extraordinarily offensive.
Isn't it?
Clear that up for us. clear that up for us.
You know, it was a sign that landlords used to post in the windows of apartments in London.
Really?
Yeah, and there were similar signs actually in Florida. They used to put no Jews, no blacks, no dogs.
Yeah,
and so it's a discriminatory kind of a hateful thing, but it's a dig more than calling somebody a horrible name. It's just it's subtle and it's vile. So we just loved it. So it actually came up during an interview we were doing with John and Don Letts, the guy who was in Big Audio Dynamite. He's a really good filmmaker.
I was wondering where your twin was.
Yeah, he's out there. Yeah. We're finishing a book today, Peter, on.
Oh, man. Well, thank you for taking the time. Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon, the Irish ancestry?
Yeah. His kin actually came from the west coast of Ireland, which was around Cork and actually sort of the tip, you know, the west coast and the tip of Ireland.
Now, you have these two incredible figures, Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon, and then David Hilliard, who was there in this amazing amount of history, was formed in the United States. And then beneath it, Keith and Kent Zimmerman. How do you guys get tied into this?
I don't know. You know, these two white boys end up with, like, punk rock legends and Black Panthers and Hell's Angels. I don't know. You know, we also teach a class at San Quentin every week. So there's something about the, you know, the edgier, you know, parts of our culture, I guess, that we relate to.
Don't get into any Lincolns.
No?
Okay, no.
Okay.
All right. But no, seriously, is this ghostwriting? Are you taking, like, these guys talking into tapes and then you make good English out of it, or what?
The definition of a ghostwriter is when you don't get any credit, when you're the kind of the person behind, you know, the with no sleeve credit. I have agents that make sure you get the cover and sleeve credit and all that.
Okay, so that was offensive.
No, it wasn't offensive. Yeah. No, because a lot of people, you know, are probably interested in writing, and it's a really good way to start a writing career is to find somebody, maybe you know somebody that's really interesting, and just say, hey, let's do a book, which is what we did with John. That started our whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, you know, we've written about a dozen books, and you're right, you know, we do. With Sonny, he lived down the hill, and we'd come home from work, and we were working in the music business at the time, and then he'd come in, and we'd just roll tapes and tell stories and transcribe them. That's what we did a lot with David, and a lot of David, the work with David was also a lot of papers left behind by Huey that no one had ever seen. that were that weren't even in the Stanford archives.
Well,
and
well, let's put some last names on here. We're talking about David Hilliard.
Yeah, who has written
Huey, the authorized biography of political activist Black Panther founder Huey P. Newton, who died in, I'm forgetting my history, 1989. So he lived from 1942. See, my memory's half there. 1942 to 1989. And if they ever, if ever was a need for the adjective mercurial, it certainly fit Huey P. Newton. And, well, just, I want to get to the book, but just tell me, is you jokingly said here these two white boys get hooked up with an ex-Black Panther, a punk rocker. How did you get hooked up with David Hilliard?
We had, after we worked with, we've done like five books with Sonny, and we got one new one coming out, actually. And one of the chapters we worked with Sonny, we did a bunch of short stories about different kinds of riders, and one of riders, R-I-D-E-R-S, bike riders. So one of the chapters was about a black Oakland club. It was a Harley Davidson black only club, outlaw club called the East Bay Dragons. So we did this book with them. It's a great book, and it's called Soul on Bike, so it's kind of a takeoff on Soul on Ice. And the
that's great.
The cover actually has Kathleen Cleaver on the back of a chopper.
Oh, my God.
Guys. So,
we should tell people that she's the widow of Eldridge Cleaver, who was also a prominent Black Panther. Yeah.
And so we ended up, one of the chapters in that book was on the Black Panthers, because the Dragons used to go to the Free Huey rallies in Defamory Park in Oakland back in the 60s. So we would, and Santana would play there, or they'd, you know, Hendrix or some, you know, they'd have a lot of music people hang out there. It was pretty wild times.
Now, there was, of course, one of the most famous chapters of the Black Panther Party during the late 1960s and early 1970s was in Oakland, California, and that's where the Hell's Angels were as well. And these guys didn't exactly, as I remember, didn't have the greatest attitude on race. Was there ever any friction between the two of them?
Well, the thing is that the guy that founded the Dragons, that kind of led us to Hilliard and the whole Black Panther thing, him and Sonny are like thick as seas.
Okay.
They've known each other since the 50s. So, you know, you can paint people with a broad brush, and it's what people say, but it's kind of what they do. And I've seen Sonny around black bikers and you know, I'm not saying that, you know, white bike clubs are, you know, it's kumbaya, but, you know,
well, but
people. You know?
But there never was any confrontation between the Black Panthers and the Hell's Angels.
Not really. I think they were just turbulent times that, you know, they all had a common enemy, which was the cops and the government,
Joining me on the Peter Werby Show is Kent Zimmerman. He and his brother Keith are the co-authors of Huey, Spirit of the Panther, and the main author is David Hilliard, a founding member and chief of staff of the Black Panther Party. Now, there may be a good number of people in the audience are still thinking, and I'm remiss as the host here, there may be thinking, who the hell is Huey P. Newton? So can we get a little capsule of who he is?
Yeah, the Black Panther Party was founded by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. And Huey P. Newton was a lot of people equate him as a Black Panther. I equate him more as a philosopher almost. And he was a brilliant scholar. And he founded the Black Panthers on, 10 or 20, I can't remember, on the principles of the party. And a lot of those principles are like health care and education and all issues that are now like vital today. So he's sort of a timeless figure.
Yeah, the Black Panther 10-point program is not particularly radical. I mean,
it's not. No. But at the time it was.
Yeah.
I mean, God, you mentioned health care then. It was communism, you know.
Yeah.
You still hear that, I guess, huh?
So Huey P. Newton, he and Bobby Seale formed the Black Panther Party, how's my memory, 1966, something like that?
Yeah, and they made a big media impact with the look and the violence and the ominous kind of image. But then Huey moved away from that when he saw that the party was moving away from the actual community. So he was more about programs than violence. so you know, so the party moved in a whole different direction, and the book talks about that, and it's pretty candid about his problems with you know, bipolar behavior and drugs and all of that stuff.
Yeah, well,
and especially prison. You
know? Well, I was going to say that he remind us of why people were saying "Free Huey" everywhere you can imagine. And there were concerts, and as I said, headlines in newspapers and demonstrations down in front of the Detroit Federal Building. I was just looking at some old photographs from the archives of the Fifth Estate newspaper, and there is a whole packet of ones that with people with signs saying "Free Huey now."
He basically walked around in the crosshairs of the FBI and the government and the local police and from law enforcement, from, you know, local to federal. He was on enemies lists, Richard Nixon's enemies list. He was considered one of the most dangerous revolutionaries in the United States, if not the most.
Well, give us some reason why. I mean, on one hand, we say there's a 10-point program that says, you know, healthcare, people don't get put on enemies' list. I mean, a lot of it is the image of them. In fact, the reality, the fact that they were armed and believed in armed self-defense, right?
Right. They would patrol the neighborhoods with shotguns. And there's some pretty graphic chapters about that, how they went, you know, how all that went down. And there was, you know, there was confrontation on the streets. You know, Huey would, he purposely carried the same shotgun that the Oakland police was issued. So he kind of leveled the playing field, so to speak, you know.
Well, image-wise, in fact, when you open up the front piece of Huey's Spirit of the Panther by David Hilliard with Keith and Kent Zimmerman, there is Bobby Seale and with a Colt 45, and Huey P. Newton with a bandolier with shotgun shells and a shotgun. Now, this is all legal, right?
Back then it was. Yeah.
But it didn't go over well with the Oakland police or police anywhere else in the United States.
Yeah, it just makes me think about, and Toby used to talk, the leader of the Black Bike Club, he used to talk about walking around with a shotgun going rabbit hunting in the wilds of Oakland, believe it or not. You know, it just makes me think about, like, we think we're so free, but God, how a lot of our freedoms have kind of slipped through our fingers.
Mm-hmm. How was it working with David Hilliard? Certainly he was a firebrand 35, going on to almost 40 years ago. He must be an older man by now, I assume, eh?
Let's just say he's still a firebrand. Can we leave it at that?
All right, we can leave it at that. And how was it working with him?
Let's say he's a firebrand. Can we leave it at that?
Okay. Yeah, we can do that. Was there any of it that surprised you when you when you heard the information? I assume that you must have taken some advance, learned about this or knew about it.
Well, I grew up in it. I'm I don't know how old you are, Peter. I'm kind of up there, you know, in my early 50s. You know, I'm a boomer.
Yeah.
So I grew up. My sister used to come home with Black Panther newspaper. Look what I got at campus, you know.
Uh-huh.
I used to look at them like, wow, what was this? You know, God, if someone had told me later that, you know, I'd be involved in a book like that, I wouldn't have believed them, you know. But it's, I don't know, it's, you know, nothing surprised me, you know, especially when you think like J. Edgar Hoover and those people running amok. How could anything surprise you?
Isn't that interesting, Kent Zimmerman, that it was the Black Panthers that were accused by the authorities of running amok, but that now that we have been able to get the files of the COINTELPRO program of the activities of the Oakland police, the Chicago police, in a celebrated death of a Black Panther there, it really was the authorities that ran amok during that period.
Yeah, they were the people that started the domino. You know, they kicked the domino, and it just, you know, it's no different today, Peter. I'm in prison every week, and you know, we're in the business of putting people in prison. I know that sounds really callous and off the hip, but it really is. It's a business.
Sure.
And you know, the law enforcement is an industry, and so you know, people kept their jobs as long as they kept the pot stirred. You know.
Well, I'm sure you use the same phrase, but we talk about here in Michigan of the prison industrial complex.
Oh man.
And it's the drug laws that create the clients.
Yeah, yeah, it's the drugs, man.
Well, tell us about Huey P. Newton and David Hillier's account of what happened with Huey P. Newton in drugs. How does he relate that? I know there were many accusations against Huey P. Newton that he had fallen into a state of real degeneration, that he'd become violent. And is this taken up, and is that those kind of...
Oh, man, you know... If and when you talk to David, he'll really, you know, elucidate about that, because they had a falling, you know, not a falling out. They couldn't hang out with each other because David finally said, "That's it, I've had enough," and sought help and went through, a program, and a 12-step program. And Huey just, like a lot of people, you know, that have substance abuse problems, just didn't want to be around anybody that was taking the plunge. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, towards the end of his life, you know, they were they had problems, you know, hanging out together, because the guy was crazy. He was scary.
This is Huey P. Newton.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had really reached a bad place. Did he die as a result of drugs?
Yeah, yeah. He was shot in a crack house. And
Oh. The
book has the first actual account of Frederica Newton, who is Huey's widow, and she was with him the last years of his life. And boy, you know, her and I just sat down and said, "Okay, let's talk." And so we in fact, we put that chapter in her voice and just let her go. And she just tells you a lot of personal, scary, amazing, wild stories. You just have to read the book to read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
The book is Huey, Spirit of the Panther. It's written by David Hilliard, who is the chief of staff of the Black Panthers, along with Keith and Kent Zimmerman. I'm talking with Kent Zimmerman. It's a foreword by Frederica Newton, as Kent just said, and it's published by Thunder's Mouth Press. Let's go back just a little to what you were talking about, some of your own activities. You say you teach a class in what prison? Folsom, was it?
No, San Quentin.
San Quentin, yeah, yeah. Isn't that where Nixon was supposed to go? No, anyway.
Yeah, man.
Let's not talk about that. What's the motivation there? Why do you do this?
We teach creative writing there in a part of the prison called the H Unit, which are the screw-ups of the screw-ups. You know, these guys aren't on the hill serving life. Lifers are the elite. These are the guys, the straggly people. But every week we go in and we got about 30 guys in the room, and it's awesome, man. I mean, I spend my weekends, my Friday nights hanging out on a prison yard, but it's just really, really wild, man. These guys have stories.
I mean, do you do this? I mean, excuse me for being crass. I mean, do you do it because it's a paycheck, or do you do it because it appeals to you?
Oh, no, I do it. I'm a volunteer. We've been doing it going on 4 years.
Okay. So then the question is, and I know sometimes when people are doing things that at least are partly altruistic, they're somewhat a little reticent about saying why. But I guess I'm interested in the motivation.
I tell you why, because I sit in this house all day long writing. You know, my brother and I, we've written like 12 books. God, in an enormous amount of time. And I like to get out of the house.
Well,
but also, it fuels you, you know. It kind of cleanses you in an odd sort of way. I mean, it's weird to go onto some horrible place and find, you know, something so wonderful, but that's actually what it is.
Well,
do God's work person by person, one by one.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, I have to say, I find myself, and I've been working on a project, and I've had my head stuck in front of a computer for 8 to 10 hours a day. So the impulse to get out is very real with me as well. But I have to say, it doesn't occur to me to want to teach a course on writing at Jackson. That's why I was curious as to
teach a course on radio or whatever your expertise is in. You know,
hey, I write.
Yeah,
I've never
writing and stuff. I recommend it. It'll blow your mind.
But that's an interesting concept, because one of the things I also do pretty well, if I don't say so myself, is edit. And the idea of taking someone who's had an extraordinary life, getting it on tape, getting more out of them, because I do interview people, as you can tell.
Yeah.
And
good
then,
interviewer, too.
Well, thank you, sir. And you're an excellent author. that really all of a sudden sounds very appealing, because as you know, as a writer, good editors are extraordinarily important to the publishing process, and they're getting to be few and far between.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
The one that we were working with Sunny on just got fired.
Oh.
Should have been.
Now, did you say you had several books on Sonny Barger?
We've done five.
We did
Hell's Angel, and then we did one called Riding High, Living Free, which was short stories. And then we did we wrote two motorcycle thrillers. One's coming out in May. The first one was called Dead in Five Heartbeats, and they're just fiction. They're motorcycle thrillers. Uh-huh. We have a hero or a protagonist, I should call him. He's pretty badass.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a thing called the Freedom Handbook. So, Sonny's like this renowned author, and we've worked on all his books with him, and he's a great guy to work with.
And how far are you guys from Hollywood? Miles?
We're 500 miles.
There you go.
But we got a couple of books that are in development right now.
You mean for film?
Yeah.
Really?
In fact, I'll tell you something. This will blow you away.
Sure.
The guy who's adapting Hell's Angel for the screen... For director Tony Scott is James Frost.
Okay.
The guy who got caught in the Oprah storm.
Right. That.
So when everybody dumped on that guy, we hung in with him and we're working with him.
That's good. Yeah, he had a little veracity problem in terms of his autobiography. Seemed to have a few things that were constructed.
Yeah, but he's a hell of a writer.
Yeah. What the hell? I mean, what are we reading for? Keith and Kent Zimmerman, along with David Hilliard, have put together Huey, Spirit of the Panther. Let's just return just for a minute to where we were beginning, to your help with John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, with his autobiography. I'm sure you caught the Sex Pistols' response to being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that was John's handwriting. I could tell that one. That was great. We used to talk about that all the time, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so that didn't surprise me at all either. So, I mean, it's sort of like the Baseball Hall of Fame. It isn't. When I was in the music business, they used to send me Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ballots, and I just thought Rock and Roll and Hall of Fame were just like, they didn't go. It didn't mix. It's just rock and roll is supposed to be rebellious, and Hall of Fame is so, I don't know what the word would be, honorable. So it's the two, and of course John came through, by saying, we ain't doing it.
Yeah, he said, I guess you can say stuff like this on the air now, he said, compared to the Sex Pistols, the Hall of Fame is a piss stain.
Yeah, it is a piss stain. So, so that didn't surprise me, because we used to, even back then when we were putting the book together back in, 93, 94, we used to laugh at it,
Well, actually, I went to a dinner at, what's a big famous hotel in New York? One of the most famous ones of all, not the Plaza, but this huge one on, Lexington or something like that. And I was thinking.
Oh, yeah, the Plaza.
Not the Plaza.
No.
But it was Sir Paul was there, and Eric Clapton was just a few feet from me, and Ray Charles played, and I thought, hell. I mean, say what you want about it. It sure was an incredible experience. Well, we're almost out of time, Kent Zimmerman. You said you and your brother are just finishing up a book. Is it anything you can tell us about?
We're actually turning it in. We're sending it to, we're working with the Tuttles, who have a television show called American Chopper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, we're working with Paul Sr. and Paul Jr. and Mikey, and the working title is Orange County Choppers, The Tale of the Tuttles. And we've spent a lot of time up in Orange County, New York, outside of New York, and God, talked with those guys and rolled tape. They have a really interesting story and their whole family, and it's a pretty cool book. So we're finishing that, and that should come out the end of this year. And then Sonny's, our book with Sonny comes out in May, called Six Chambers, One Bullet, and that's another a thriller. So, we got a bunch of stuff coming out.
Well, great work. Now, let me say thank you for joining us. The book is called Huey, Spirit of the Panther. It's written by David Hilliard, and it's also done with Keith and Kent Zimmerman. Kent Zimmerman has been my guest. It's available from Thunder's Mouth Press. That's hard to say.
Yeah, I know.
Thunder's Mouth Press. Right. But thank you, Kent Zimmerman, for being my guest on the Peter Werbe Show.
Have a good one.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. One of the issues revolving around the candidacy of John Kerry for the presidency is the fact that he was a member of an organization called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. These were returning Vietnam vets who disliked the war they had just fought. They took part in all sorts of dramatic actions. They threw back medals. They led anti-war demonstrations. And for the people that were opposed to the war at that time, they were the heroes of the anti-war movement, as we've come to find out, of course, for those people that support George W. Bush and some veterans of the Vietnam War. That was a horrible thing for John Kerry to have done. John Kerry's testimony, which is available to Congress in 1971 or 1972, I forgot the date, is available on my website at peterwerby.com. But our guest, in many ways, just has reminded me how long this war has been going on already. And the reason that it has is that my guest, Mike Hoffman, has founded Iraq Veterans Against the War. From Philadelphia, it's a pleasure to welcome Mike Hoffman. Mike, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, you always have to start, unfortunately, with your credentials. We're always stateside or we're a cook. Not that those people aren't deserving of respect. So tell us about your military history, maybe even going back to your motives for joining the U.S. Marines in the first place.
Right. Well, just like you said, I was a member of the United States Marine Corps. I served 4.5 years and received an honorable discharge last August. I joined up in 99. I'm from northeastern Pennsylvania, area that's been hit real hard job-wise, things like that. So when I left high school, I wasn't going straight off to college. There weren't many job opportunities. And when the recruiter came up, offered me 3 square meals a day, a regular paycheck, a roof over my head, and the ability to see the world. And while doing all this, being able to protect my country and get something back to it, it was a really strong offer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if, for instance, like there is in some countries, and there used to be to some extent here in the United States, there would have been free college tuition, do you think you might have wound up in college instead of the Marines, or was the Marines a draw in and of itself?
The Marines were a draw in and of themselves, but, you know, just with the way things are set up right now in this country, definitely college weighs into it. It's not the only reason, like people make it sound so often in the news right now. It is definitely something that makes people think a little bit harder about the military. But all in all, they join up because they have this, they feel that they want to give something back to this country and to the rest of the world.
Now, you, Mike Hoffman, you joined the Marines, and take us up to Kuwait in February 2003. The war is just about to begin. So your unit was shipped over to Kuwait?
Right. We had just finished a 6-month deployment in Okinawa, Japan. I personally thought I was leaving the Marines. I was supposed to be discharged in February. My contract was up, and then the stop-loss order came down. Myself, as well as thousands of other service members, found our terms extended, and basically our lives were put on hold, and many of us were sent into combat, like myself.
Mm-hmm. What we should remind people, in fact, you went over the phrase kind of quickly, stop loss. Explain what that is and why you were supposed to be discharged and what a stop loss order is.
Right. Well, stop loss, or what John Kerry calls the backdoor draft. What most people don't realize and what isn't explained to you very well, myself included, when you sign up for the military, is that it's not just 4 years and out like they make it sound. It's actually an 8-year contract. It's 4 years active duty, which is what most people think of. And what they don't talk about too much is the 4 years inactive reserve time. That is what allows them to do the stop loss. Now, when I signed up, I wasn't told about the full 8-year contract until literally my pen was on the paper. I was about to sign my name in the last sheet when the master gunnery sergeant all of a sudden told me, well, you'd realize this is an 8-year contract.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us what unit you were in? Is that something, or is that...
Yeah, no. Well, the unit, when I was doing that paperwork, that was a completely different group than who I actually served with.
Who'd you serve with?
I served with Romeo Battery, 5th Battalion, 10th Marines, but we were detached from our home battalion, and reinforced 5th Battalion, 11th Marines in Iraq.
And when you are mentioned as a combat veteran, besides a founder of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, that means you were shooting at people and people were shooting back at you. Tell us a little about that.
Right. We were generally very, very lucky over there. Our unit took no casualties. Everybody came home in one piece. A lot of very, very close calls. Being an artillery battery, we weren't up front the whole time. We were giving supporting fire. But I was on what's called advanced party. Because an artillery battery is such a large, lumbering thing that we would send out about 30 Marines ahead to scout out the position, check for booby traps, check the general lay of the land, things like that. And I was one of those Marines.
Mm-hmm.
So we were getting pushed up in front, oftentimes in front of the infantry, to scout out these new positions. And I saw the immediate aftermath of what had gone on. Just cities in absolute ruins, things like that. And there were a couple times, like I said, very close calls. At one point, our position was almost overrun by Iraqi infantry. Luckily, there was a group of LAR, Light Armored Reconnaissance, directly in back of our position, and they took the brunt of the Iraqi attack. But, you know, being in artillery, one of the last things you want to have is infantry getting that close to your position.
Well, in February of 2003, you arrived in Kuwait at the same time on February 15th, 2003. Millions of people throughout the world, including myself, protested against this impending war. Said there was we said there were no weapons of mass destruction,
right,
and that there was no need to immediately begin the war. What was your feeling as an active duty Marine? That you must have thought this my life could end in the next couple of months.
Right, and it's something we were very, very well aware of. Everybody didn't feel the same way about the war. I didn't think we should go in. Things didn't make sense to me. I just, like you were saying in the protests, why weren't we giving weapons inspectors more time? I think one of the worst things about the weapons inspections is that they're being asked to prove a negative.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they had to prove that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. If we look at the American justice system, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. Well, when it came to weapons of mass destruction and the inspections, Iraq was guilty until proven innocent, which completely changes the scope of things over there.
Sure.
And that, to me, made no sense, especially when it was my life on the line over this.
You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. My guest is Mike Hoffman. He's the founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I'm remiss in not telling people that that Mike Hoffman and others are featured in a story, lead story on the cover of the November-December Mother Jones magazine. MotherJones.com will get you right to the magazine. You can even read the article online, but please support the independent press. Go out and buy a copy, or better yet, take out a subscription. Actually, I find myself being extraordinarily interested in your experiences in Iraq, but I could imagine never getting to the foundation of this organization. Take us quickly, if you will, through combat and then you're discharged. How much longer were you held in the service beyond when you thought you were going to discharged?
Right. I actually ended up serving an extra 6 months on top of my regular 4 years.
All right. So you were discharged. You got an honorable discharge. You came back to the United States, and boom. What then all of a sudden, had you heard, you must have heard of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Not really. Not
really.
Until I really stepped out and started speaking out. I got back to the States in May. It wasn't until November that I spoke out publicly for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot in between where I was just trying to figure things out, get my head straight, and make sense of what was going on over there, because being there and looking back at it from the outside are two completely different things. But it wasn't until November of last year, almost a year now, that I spoke out publicly for the first time, and it was only because I finally met up with people from Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace. They, for me, as well as for many other veterans that in Iraq Veterans Against the War and other people, have really been a godsend for us. These people have been through it. They know what we've gone through, and they've done a lot to help us through this tough time.
On the other hand, there are certainly Vietnam vets, and we've seen a lot of them come forward that want to consign, actually now it seems to be only John Kerry, but other people that were in the Vietnam vets, veterans against the war, to the hottest room in hell. I mean, they... go ahead.
It was those guys, I feel for them, I really do. After being through combat myself and meeting other guys who go through there, you know, we kind of talked and we realized that coming back from war and seeing horrible things like that, you kind of go through three stages. To keep yourself going at first, you really buy into everything with the war. And you protect that because that's what's keeping you together after seeing what happened over there, you know. And these are the guys that you see in Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and all these other groups. Then there are a lot of guys who realize that horrible things happened over there, that it wasn't a good war, but they blame themselves. That's when you see numbers like right now, believe it or not, twice as many Vietnam veterans have committed suicide than actually died in Vietnam.
No.
That's the cause of numbers like that. And then you've got people like myself, Veterans for Peace, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who realize that horrible things happened. That you know, innocent people died, good people died, but it's not their fault. It's not the fault of the people they were fighting. It's the fault of the people who put them in that situation in the first place. The fault, you know, horrible things happen, but the fault lies with the people who made the decisions.
Well, maybe, I'm completletely sympathetic with your point of view, but let me take the devil's advocate point of view. Some of my listeners think I'm the devil's advocate in any event,
right.
But war is hell. We know that. People get killed. Your job is literally to kill people, why the shock over seeing death and destruction? That's what you're trained to do, and ostensibly to defend this country against its enemies.
Right, and here's the thing. I was not a pacifist before I joined the military, and I'm not a pacifist after seeing war. But here's the thing. There's no such thing as a good war. Whoever tells you that is a liar. All war is bad. You know, horrible, horrible things happen in a war, no matter what you're fighting the war over. But here's the trick, though. Before you go to war, before you're putting lives like mine and other people's on the line, you need to make damn sure that this war is unavoidable, that you have done everything in your power to make sure that this war did not have to be fought, and that did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had numerous opportunities, and they still had numerous things they could have done before going to war. They chose war as a first resort, not a last resort, and that is what's fundamentally wrong about this.
Mike Hoffman's my guest, founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Have you tell me about the contact you've had with other Vietnam vets and with any active duty GIs. How do they respond to your efforts?
Generally, with the exception of the real far right people, they've got a very positive response. Even people who don't agree with my position respect it.
When you say people, you mean, tell me exactly, who do you mean?
Right.
Veterans or?
Yeah, veterans, guys who serve, because after putting their life on the line for something like this, they realize that this is what they put their life on the line for, to protect freedoms like freedom of speech. They would never tell me to shut up. They'll be the first person to say, I don't agree with your position, but they say that I have every right to say this. And they understand where I'm coming from also. But also, we've got guys right now in this organization that are in active duty. We've got members in IVAW that are in Iraq right now fighting in places like Samarra, Ramadi, Fallujah. You know, this is not just a bunch of guys who, sat in supply bases over there. These are guys who saw frontline combat, who are part of the invasion. You know, we've got a surprising number of Marines in this group right now. Marines who are with the infantry who saw frontline combat.
And it looks like it's going to get worse as soon as this election is over, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Military officials are already coming out and saying they're openly admitting that as soon as the election's over, they're going to mount some serious offensive. And I've got, I've talked to people and I'm hearing anecdotal evidence that a lot of movement orders are coming in, are starting to come down for right after the election.
Hmm. Now, why is it that so many of your comrades in arms are going to vote for George W. Bush, given the fact that, everything from his military experience to Kerry's military experience to the fact that it must be obvious that now, with the fact that there were, that the main rationale for going into Iraq has been emptied of any meaning, you would think they would overwhelmingly support his opponent.
Right. I don't trust a lot of the polls. It's been shown time and time again that a lot of these polls are coming out in very biased ways. But what I'm hearing from people is that, well, first of all, in the military, there's a huge difference between those who have been to Iraq and have served there and those who haven't. Those who have been to Iraq, I'm hearing much more from them that they're supporting John Kerry, not so much because they like him, but just as a protest against Bush. Those who haven't been over there are voting differently. So I think that says a lot.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I should tell people as well that you can contact Iraq Veterans Against the War by going to IVAW.net. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right.
It's also on my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. How about family and neighbors? Usually neighborhoods and families are very proud of their children that are in the armed services, but there's always an attempt to be made. Anyone who protests a military effort is somehow under suspicion, particularly by a lot of military families. How are those folks looking at you?
Well, you got to understand, right now, one of the biggest groups within the anti-war movement right now is Military Families Speak Out. They have something like 1,500 member families of families of those who are serving in the military right now. So this is, even the polls have come out and said that military families are less supportive of the war than they are than the outside population.
Hmm.
Now, here's what you got to look at. They're less supportive of the war. They will support the troops with everything they have, but they're not supporting the war. These are two completely different things. You can support the troops without supporting the war, and in this case, supporting the troops and not supporting the war is the best thing you can do.
How do you do that, though? I've often even wondered what that slogan meant. I was always afraid that support our troops translated into support the war.
Well, here's the best way to sum it up, and it's been a rally cry of many groups right now. Support the troops. Bring them home now.
Right. Well, I'm certainly on board with that one.
You know, just like I've said, they're making us put our lives on the line for a war that's been shown to be nothing but lies, for a war that we're not going to get anything out of.
How about older vets? I know that during the era of the Vietnam era, when Vietnam Veterans Against the War was established, they got incredible hostility from, like, the American Legion, who had fought in Korea and in World War II. Have you had any reaction, like, from the established military groups, military veterans groups?
Not too much. I haven't dealt much with groups like American Legion, Veterans of Foreign Wars, things like that. But, you know, the Vietnam veterans, the guys who remember how they were treated by those other groups have really been the backbone of this. When we first, one of our first major actions was August 31st at the RNC, you know, when we had a 500,000 people out in the streets.
In New York at the Republican Convention. Right,
right, exactly. Right. And we had a veterans meeting at Central Park at a place called Summit Rock. And one of the things that really stuck with me is that a Vietnam veteran taught us all the lessons they learned, both good and bad, and we have took those and really used those to help us out in what we're doing right now.
Ever thought, Mike Hoffman, what if I run for president? How will, man, look what happened. I don't know. I don't know whether this is certainly John Kerry's amazing opposition to the war and his brave, courageous, steadfast opposition to the war. And his you've heard his speech to Congress, have you?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
Right. It frustrates me even more that in a lot of ways he's run away from that. You know, I'm not a John Kerry supporter right now. I'll end up reluctantly voting for him. But if he would be right now standing by what he said back then in the Winter Soldier trials as steadfastly as he did back then, I would have no problems supporting him. But, I have no problems with what I'm saying right now. And it's
spread out over quite an area, but they said that they found about 50 pro-Kerry signs. Overwhelmingly, this is being seen by most of us as a referendum. You had just been interviewed by Italian TV. Is this unusual? I mean, the fact that you got some media attention from so far away?
No, it's not. I'm
surprised that you haven't had any real ferocious opposition. There is a couple of very, very right-wing groups that support Bush that take out we've seen the attack dogs on just sort of this.
Yeah, a couple of other notable Vietnam veterans. But, no, it's nothing really targeted against me yet.
Well, I feel bad. I mean, I'm not on it either. Or you are now. No,
yeah,
I
am. I'm to a point. Right now I'm just so slammed just trying to keep up with what's going on in Iraq right now. But whenever I get a chance, I try to read up about the history of this and other movements overall to educate myself and learn from their lessons.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. If I'm sure there's both. What do you need from them? What do you want from them? What would you'd like more members, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, the more members we have is really a strong thing. Even if they can't speak out because they're active duty, they're scared to speak out or something like that. But the ability for us to walk up to, you know, a senator or a congressman and say, we have, you know, 300 members who have served.
December 2004, Mother Jones Magazine. You can go to motherjones.com and find out, read more details about it. And online, it's ivaw.net. Mike Hoffman, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. These and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater mission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. Hot plus smart equals 30 G's a year.
Money, 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 money.
And a hot new car.
whipped with scripts and fake breasts. Find a nest in the hills, chill like Flint, buy an old drop top, find a